This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on July the 27th, 2001. Our speaker is Kamala F. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Kamala, I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm a little nervous here. This is my first time doing this. I've never been asked to do a speaker meeting, and when I was asked a few weeks ago, it was taught to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that whenever I'm asked to do something, that I do it. And so therefore it was asked of me, and I thought, shit. And now's my time. My number is up, and so I'm here. So anyways, I just want to welcome everybody who's new, our visitors. And if, you know, you don't hear something here tonight that you relate to or that you just don't like my share or whatever, I open you to go to another meeting. We have lots of meetings here at this facilities. Otherwise, there's many of them in this county. And what I was told when I first got here is to listen for the similarities, not for the differences. And what I found is that I deeply related with just about everybody here. If it's not with their particular alcoholic story, it was with their feelings, it was with the way they lived, and so that's what I stayed open to, and I realized that this is the place where I belonged. Start off, I guess I'll just, you know, I got, wow, a whole hour to share about me. And I'll let you know that my sobriety date is March 12, 1994. It wasn't my first sobriety date. I got here, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous December 26, 1993. No, actually, I was introduced to jail December 26, 1993. I was actually introduced here December 28th. To share about myself, I grew up in a broken home. My mom raised me and my brother. I was 10 months away from my brother. He was 10 months older than I was. And my mom had us both by the time she was 18. I couldn't say that I was exactly a planned child. But, you know, my mom did the best she could. My dad and her broke up, split up, I think when I was a year or 1 month old, somewhere around there. I wasn't very old at all. So I never really had that father figure in my life. But, you know, my mom did the best she could. We didn't grow up with the finest of things in the home. You know, we were lucky if we had food. So, you know, like I said, my mom did the best she could. My mom also was very loving towards my brother, and I didn't get that same reactions from my mom. For what reason, I don't know, but I know that I always felt, as a child, kind of alienated from the family. I had grown up in the mountains with my mom and my brother, and when I went to my grandparents' house, it was my grandparents and my four uncles, and that was basically the atmosphere in which I grew up with. Everyone who lived in my community that I played with was a bunch of little boys, so I kind of felt like a tomboy. I felt like I really related with the boys. I didn't have a sister, not very many girls. And the girls that I did play with when I was little, we ended up, I wasn't allowed to play with them anymore because I got them in trouble. Basically, I would get them to side with me. They'd be my little sidekick in stealing or something like that. So they, whenever we got caught, they were asked not to hang out with me anymore. So I was always hanging out with the boys, playing on bikes, climbing trees, doing stuff like that. The only place that I ever really felt comfortable was at my grandmother's house, and that was because, you know, she was the one person in my family that gave me that unconditional love, that always seemed to care about me, that held me and nurtured me and didn't seem to want anything from me but for me to grow up happy and loved. and I didn't get that from my home life, the place that I spent most of my time. But I did from this one woman, and she was a beautiful woman. I love her to death today. But anyways, when I hit grade school, I ended up getting in trouble when I was in grade school, in sixth grade actually. I'd done it many times, but I got caught in sixth grade for stealing. And this is one of the girls that I had sidekick with me to help me steal stuff, you know, pencils, erasers, crayons, all that important stuff that a sixth grader needed. And so she ended up telling on us, and here I thought we were going to get away with this, and she told on us, and I ended up getting in bigger trouble than she did. I ended up getting suspended, and she got to stay in school. But when I came back to school, everybody kind of alienated me out once again. You know, here I didn't fit in at home. I didn't fit in at school, and I was really a very timid, scared person because I didn't think anybody liked me. And my actions were that, you know, why should they? Because here I'm the person who I'm playing with you, but at the same time, when you're not looking, I'm stealing from you. You know, I was stealing out of your desk, and that was my behavior. Anyways, I went back to school, like I said, and I felt really embarrassed. You know, I did something that I was very embarrassed by, and nobody wanted to play with me anymore, and once again, I was all by myself. My brother wasn't the most nurturing of people. He was, like I said, 10 months older than me, and he liked to use me as a pincushion. He liked to beat the hell out of me, and it seemed like every time he hurt me or hit me or threw something at me, it hit one of my, like, protruding little bones here, you know, and I was, like, instantly, like, in tears because he was always, you know, doing mean things like that, like I guess brothers do. Well, some anyways, mine. And so, anyways, I get into junior high school, and from there I didn't know really where to go because all my peers when I was in grade school didn't want to hang out with me anymore, and they found their own friends, and I didn't really know who quite to hang out with, so I ended up hanging out with my brother's friends, you know, and they were the people who hung out on the grass in the field smoking pot and doing whatever they did, you know, playing these little, you know, touchy-feely games and stuff with each other. And I just kind of hung out and knew what was going on. I remember this one girl, she kind of, I don't know, forced her way into my life one way or another. She started saying, yeah, I'm going to come spend the night at your house. And she came over and, you know, we went down to the park from my house, and we were playing with this other boy, and she was, you know, doing her little thing, trying to get his attention by flirting with him. And when we got back home, my mom was really mad at me, and so she ended up slapping me in front of this other girl. And you know, that was kind of humiliating for me. That was the kind of behavior I got from my mom. You know, I was out too late too, but you know, that was the kind of things that I dealt with. My mom always let my brother do whatever he wanted. If I wanted to do something, it was absolutely no. I couldn't go out. I couldn't hang out with people. It was kind of stay home by my side and just kind of reap the benefits of my anger. And so that's what I did. I was, like I said, very scared. My mom was somebody that I cringed around. She was the type of person, when she walked into the house, the way she closed the door, everyone knew she was mad. You know, she didn't close it, she slammed it. And, you know, the whole house would scatter. You know, it's like, oh, shit, she's home and she's mad. You know, so everyone would scatter, and that's what I grew up with. When these eighth graders that I was hanging out with in junior high school ended up going to high school, I didn't know, once again, who to hang out with. I was a loner person. I was the type of girl or the type of person, I know that there's all those at school, you know, that hung out by themselves. The one person that everyone picked on, I wasn't the one, I mean, there were several, but I was one of them, that everyone picked on, that that teased. And me being a very sensitive person, you know, I was constantly, you know, just feeling very small next to everybody else, feeling not that I fit in, and here I don't fit in, like I said, at home or at school. And, you know, every now and then I would have somebody to hang out with at lunch, but it was somebody different all the time, you know. It wasn't always the same person. I did not have a set group of people. I remember I was finally led into the people I used to go to grade school with, and I hung out with them for a few days, and this one girl turned around, and she looked at me, and she said, "Kamala, why don't you stop following us around like a fucking puppy dog, you know?" And, you know, that hurt my feelings, you know? Here I thought, you know, these are my peers, you know? I finally found some people to hang out with, and they didn't want anything to do with me. And, you know, once again, I didn't know how to react like to that. I didn't know how to fit in with women, you know? I didn't know how to fit in with girls, you know, and do girl things. I was a thief. I was stealing by the time I was 4 years old. I went to, you know, the store, and I saw these other people taking Brock's candy, so I did too, you know, and I got in trouble for it. But I didn't learn my lesson then. I tried it again, you know, until I got it down pretty darn good. Anyway, you know, these girls told me to stop following them around, and they all kind of, the other ones laughed, you know, at me. And, you know, I had the experience of these people signing, bringing a petition to me. They brought this petition up to me that about 80 kids in the school signed for me to cut my hair. You know, that they, and this was like proof, 80 people of proof that I was not liked, that these people just did not like me. You know, and for one reason or another, that's how I took it, is that I was this person that was unlikable, that I was this dork, this dweeb, this person. And you know what, honestly, that was the kind of stuff that I heard at home, too. I was not brought up in the most supporting of homes, you know. I was told that I was stupid, you know, that I was a moron, that I was ugly, that I was all these, you know, negative things. That was the kind of atmosphere that I grew up in. And, you know, when I got to school, they just validated all of it. And so, like I said, when I got this petition, you know, it just kind of, you know, proved to me that I was just this little piece of shit, you know, that nobody liked me, and they proved it to me. Anyway, I ended up barely graduating junior high school, and I graduated there at the ripe old age of 15, older than the oldest kid in the whole school. I had stayed back in third grade. Which, you know, kind of made me feel a little different, too. I was the oldest kid in two different schools. And, you know, everyone told me how stupid I was, too. So it made me kind of, it validated a lot of that stuff. Anyways, I get into high school, and once again, you know, I meet up with my brother, and I get to hang out with his friends again. And now we're at the 7-Eleven. I went to Los Gatos High School. And Los Gatos High School and being poor, for me, did not mix. You know, I got all these girls running around, you know, with all this nice stuff on, you know. They got money, and they have, you know, new pants. They have, like, you know, designer pants. And I have, like, you know, Mervyn's brands, whatever, you know, on sale, you know, 2-for-1, whatever I had, you know. And, you know, Zips, you know, tennis shoes or whatever. So my mom, you know, she didn't have much money, but she did what she could. And I just didn't feel like I belonged. But what I didn't know how to do was steal. And so what I did is I stole from these girls quite often. You know, I had to kind of measure up. Basically, what I would do in order to fit in, this is my little survival skill I learned, in order to fit in with the environment that I was put in, I ended up stealing in order to look like I wasn't a poor person, you know. So I stole to kind of make myself look a little bit more, I guess, wealthy. Anyways, so I would flaunt the stuff that I had, even though it was their stuff. Anyway, look what you don't have anymore. This is mine. Like I said, I get into into high school, and I'm hanging out with my brother's friends. I start hanging out with them, and you know, these are the kids that hung out at 7-Eleven, and they smoked pot, they drank, they did all that stuff. And I'm 15 years old. I wasn't quite sure if this is what I wanted to do, you know, but I followed, you know. And one day it came up, and I ended up smoking pot. And I remember how nervous I was, and I remember hallucinating, and I remember you know, just being very, very paranoid and wondering when it was going to stop. And I was asking the person, I'm like, "Oh, you know, this is where I'm at right now in this high. Am I almost over, or is it just still going on, or what?" You know, and, you know, they kind of babysat me for a while. And regardless of those feelings that I felt and what happened to me that day, I believe it was a couple days after, by the end of the week, I ended up owning a bunch of that pot that made me feel so nervous. On top of that, as far as alcoholism goes, I can't remember the first time I ever had a drink. I didn't drink like alcoholically throughout my grade school, junior high school years. I remember there was times when I was really young, about 5 years old. My grandpa would shoot off the champagne lid, and I'd go chasing it through the house, and I'd grab it, and I'd go bring it back to him, and he'd fill it up with champagne, and that was my glass. My champagne glass was the cork, And so, he'd fill it up, and I'd drink it, and I felt like I felt like I kind of belonged in a way. Like, this is something that adults do, And I remember, there was a lot of times in my life that I saw these people, the way they act. I never thought I acted the same way. I felt that, I was very immature and very childish compared to everybody else. All these people are trying to act like adults, and I'm just trying to fit in. And all of a sudden I do something really kind of, childish, and they point it out and they belittle me for that, And so I thought, well, by the time I'm 10, I'll have this down, I'll act a little bit more mature. And it happened for many years. By the time I'm 17, by the time I'm 21, then I'll fit in more like an adult, But never did I, I'm a very childlike person, I still am, and I love who I am today. I absolutely have fun, and it says in the book that we insist on having fun, and I do. I have a blast. My life is absolutely fun, and I love it. Not to say it doesn't have its ups and downs, but for the most part, I'm a very fun person, for me anyways, my behavior when I get into high school was, I was babysitting a lot. I was that responsible type where, they would call me up. I lived up in the mountains, and I was like the only girl around that was old enough to babysit. So I had lots of babysitting jobs just about every weekend, and I would commit to that because, like I said, I didn't have much money, but I liked having money on me. My mom didn't have it. I had to earn it myself. So I babysat quite a bit, and while I was there, I would steal from there. I'd go in there with an empty backpack, pretending I had homework to do or that I was going to actually do it, and I'd leave there with my backpack stuffed full so heavy I could hardly carry it sometimes, and whatever they thought, I don't know if they even noticed, but I remember one time I stole a bottle of tequila from the babysitter's house. It was, I think, mezcal or something like that, the kind with the little worm on the bottom. And I took it to school, and that was my lunch the next day. It was a bottle of tequila. And, I don't remember the first time I drank when I was in high school or when it started, but I remember that, it was a part of being an adult. And when I got loaded, it was about fitting in. It was about how I felt when I did it. And it changed the way I felt about me. I felt like I fit in, and people liked me then, and unlike how they ever felt about me before. So I ended up going through high school when I was still a junior. Wait, no, didn't make that far. What is it? Freshman. When I was a freshman, I cut school for the first time, and after I did that, my behavior is very obsessive, I guess is the word, compulsive. That's it, compulsive. And, once I tried something, I continued doing it, or I did it compulsively. So anyways, I cut school. And so from then on out, I continued doing it just about every day, at least a few classes, And on those times that I wasn't in class, I was getting loaded. That was my thing. I remember that there was many times where, I didn't know always the people I was hanging out with. I didn't know. There was a lot of fear, in my life. It wasn't always a picnic. It was about trying to have fun, but I was always kind of nervous. Anyways, when I became a sophomore. it progressively got more, you know, that whole, you know, freshman sophomore leap, you know, I ended up getting a little bit more into the disease over summer and ended up dropping out of high school and going to a continuation school. I didn't do too well at that either. I started working full-time at Lucky's down the street here when it used to be Lucky's on Saratoga and Payne. And what I did is I started working 40 hours and going to school, kind of getting loaded, and that was it. You know, that was my life. That's who I had become. I used to play the violin. I used to run cross country, and all those things became nothing to me. They weren't a big deal anymore. Those things, all those things that I liked to do became unimportant in my life, and I ended up dropping out of high school to work full time because this job was what was providing me to feed my addiction, my alcoholism. I would go to work and I would leave there, or by the end of the night, I would be going through the back room. They have the roll up doors in the back where the loading dock was, and I would run in the back with a shopping cart and fill it up with beer and push it to the back, and then someone would come pick me up and we would go pick up the beer and go have a party. Basically what happened was I ended up meeting this person, this girl that I knew. She ended up asking me if I wanted to go party with these two guys, these two friends of hers, and I didn't know them, and this was my brother's kind of girlfriend, and she wanted me to go party with these two other guys beyond my brother, and I wasn't feeling too good about it, but she kept, you know, asking me, and it kind of made me feel good that someone wanted to pay some attention to me. So I ended up saying, okay, I'll go do this with you, you know, and so we ended up getting picked up by these two guys, and we went to their mobile home out on Lewis Road, Monterey, and we ended up drinking that night. For my first time, I did a beer bong, you know, and just drinking all that night. And this my friend and this other guy, they ended up leaving, and they came back. No, they ended up leaving, and me and this other guy were there, and we're just drinking, and we go down this other lady's house, this old lady's house, and we were drinking there, and for some reason pot came up, and so he ended up going over to his trailer to get my purse, which had all my pot in it, and I remember he brings it back, and I open it up, and the smell of it, you know, just kind of made me just nauseous. You know, I had been drinking quite a bit, and I wasn't used to, you know, doing beer bongs, how fast it went into my system, and ended up throwing up all over in her bathroom, you know, and I don't know how long I was in there, but I guess he was helping me out by holding me up to the toilet, you know, and stuff like that. This is someone I've known for like a few hours, and I remember he figured it was time to go home. It's enough time that I was in her bathroom. So he walked me home. He literally had to just about, you know, pick me up and carry me home. But I kind of stumbled over to his house. And it was only like three mobile homes down, but I swear it took like a half an hour for me to get down there. And in that time, when we got back to his house, he put me in the bathroom, of course, still throwing up all over the place. And, you know, he held my hair back as I puked in the toilet for, you know, good few hours, you know, and in between me, you know, being passed out, he would hold me in his arms. And, you know, I know there was this moment where I looked at him and I thought, damn, this guy is so sweet, you know. I'm going to owe this guy, and you know what? This is the man for me. And so I ended up, you know, we ended up kissing that night, you know, and he figured, you should probably drink some water. You've been barfing here, you know, so anyway. You know, it was love. It was pure love, you know. So, you know, the next day I go to work, and it was New Year's Eve that night, but go to work, and my boss said I could go home because I wasn't feeling good. I was a little hungover. And so, you know, I end up getting on the phone, and I call them up, and I tell them to come pick me up. I wanted to go back over there and party. And I was 17 at the time still. Anyways, they pick me up, take me back over there. We're partying, you know, and, you know, being a compulsive person, I ended up staying there, you know. I was there all the time. I couldn't stop thinking about him. I wanted to be with him, you know. Okay, obsessive. We'll say it, obsessive. Anyways, ended up spending quite a bit of time there, but I was not able to spend the night there. My mom would, like, have a fit, you know, when I wanted to spend the night out. Like I said, my mom did not let me do anything but let my brother do it all. So I ended up, you know, when I turned 18, which was a few months later, my birthday was the end of February, when I turned 18, about a week later, I told my mom, you know, I'm moving out, you know. And there was a certain amount of I don't know if it was guilt or pain there, sadness, you know, that my mom didn't do anything to me to the point where I wanted to hurt her back that bad. But, you know, I thought about it. It's like, how sad, you know. It's like I moved out from my mom's house the minute I turned 18. Like, I just couldn't wait to get the fuck out, you know. And to some extreme, to some point it was that. But honestly, my reasoning for moving out and moving in with this guy was because I wanted to party. And I didn't want any restrictions. I didn't want to, you know, have her come banging on my doors telling me to stop smoking pot in the bedroom, you know, in her newly built house, you know. It's like, you can't be doing that, you know, and getting mad at me and slapping me or whatever, you know. I didn't want to deal with that, you know. I wanted to get loaded, you know, and do whatever without mom over my shoulder. So, basically, I did lose my job at Lucky's for stealing, who would have guessed. Got busted. Didn't stop me, though. And so, you know, I'm living at this guy's house, you know, for free. I had no job, you know, so I'm living at his house just getting loaded all the time. That's what my life became. And you know what? I was okay with that for a while. And then I decided, you know, maybe I should participate for a little bit. So I ended up getting this job at this yogurt store, and I made $4.10 an hour, you know, minimum wage. And, you know, all my money then went to me getting loaded. It helped me see my disease once again. Anyways, this was a place, this was a job. Let me tell you all that this is a job that I was able to close the doors, lock the doors, and go in the bathroom and get loaded, and then, you know, reopen the store. Nobody would miss it. You know, it's a little yogurt store. I'm the only one there. So it was very convenient to my disease. I ended up getting another job. I worked at Knob Hill. I ended up getting a job at Knob Hill probably about 10 months later. And there I ended up meeting some people that didn't know me for who I was when I was in school or knew me growing up. You know, they kind of, you know, let me fit in. I know earlier when I was talking, I told you all that, you know, I was belittled in my family, being told that I was, you know, stupid and ugly and stuff like that. And I'll tell you, when I was in, when I was going into 10th grade, my grandma took me out and got me a perm, you know. And I was walking home, and I started getting attention for the first time from men. And, you know, I got honked at, and it's like, oh, wow, that was for me, you know. And it was pretty cool, you know. I kind of felt, you know, cute then. And anyways, when I went into this job at Knob Hill, these guys, you know, I started getting that attention. And it felt good, you know. I didn't feel like that ugly little child. And these people didn't know who I was as this stupid person, as this thief, as this this shy, timid person yet, you know. But I was new, and they accepted me in for who I was. And they talked to me, and they could tell that I was part of the group that was going to get loaded with them. And basically, that's what they did. They found me out. I found them out. That's how I worked. I didn't want to hang out with people that didn't get loaded. So, you know, we sought out each other, and that's what we did. This guy that I was living with, he ended up becoming a little too possessive for me. He didn't want me to go out and party with new people, and I started getting a crush on this guy at work. So, I was kind of irritated that he didn't want me hanging out with these people. And he didn't want them, you know, he didn't want to go over to their house, and, you know, they didn't want to come over to our house. So I started doing my behavior of, you know, lying again, you know, and I'd tell him, oh, I need to work some overtime, you know, and I'd go and party. And a lot of this was because I wanted to hang out with this one guy. So basically, What happened was he started getting really possessive, not wanting me to do anything, and there was this one moment where I was telling my friend all my woes, and she said, well, you know, if you ever need a place to live or stay, you can stay at my house. And you know what, I kept that in memory. And one night when he decided to kick me out, my fiance, he ended up being my fiance, and when he decided to kick me out, I said, okay. You know, I handed him the ring back, and I was done and over with that relationship. Not that easy and clean. I'm not a totally heartless person, but, you know, I ended up, you know, I had an escape. I had a place to go. So I took her up on it. And, you know, a big reason on why I took her up on it is because this other guy that I was so attracted to was there all the time. Perfect. It's funny how I worked that out. You know, I'm there all the time. I'm kind of sad because I'm not here, and this guy's not quite giving me the attention that I wanted. And I remember, you know, it says in the book or somewhere in our literature that, you know, that we end up seeking to lower companionship at some point. It says something like that. And, you know, I remember that there was some people that I ended up hanging out with that to this day I don't even know who they were, where they really came from, what their names were. And I remember my girlfriend and this guy that I liked ended up coming outside one day as I'm getting in these guys' cars, and these are big burly guys with big leather jackets on, and here little old me with this little tiny skimpy dress on, you know, it's getting out, you know, going to go play with these big guys. And they said, Cam, you're going to get hurt, you know, who are these people? And I said, they're my friends and we're going to a party. And you know what, honestly, I don't think there was a party that night. We didn't go to a party. I remember we drove down the street. I don't remember what we did, but you know, I wanted to feel like I had some kind of life. And, you know, even if it was a made-up one. You know, I've heard in these rooms, you know, through people telling their stories that, you know, they had, that they would wait, you know, till certain times to drink, you know, if it was after work and stuff. You know, I wasn't quite that type of alcoholic. I was the type that when I got up, I was loaded. I didn't know how to wait. You know, if it wasn't there ready for me, there wasn't something available to me the minute I woke up, you know, I was very distressed. I worked in, you know, like I said, at Knob Hill. I was a bagger. I had to help everybody out to their car, and my car was out there too, and every now and then I would go in you know, go to my car and get loaded. That's how I was. That's how my disease was. I was very compulsive, very obsessive. I could not wait till the end of the work shift, or I could not wait till after I had a shower. It was immediate, right from the beginning of my day. Anyways, what happened to me was one day I was driving to work. It was the day after Christmas, December 26, 1993. I was driving to work doing about 90 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone when I passed by a cop smoking a bong. And I didn't see him. I was not paying attention. You know, I had my mind on other things. I had to get to work, and I had to, you know, be as loaded as I possibly could be before I actually got on the clock to last me a little while until I could get back out to my car, you know, to do it. You know, I very much under the grips of the disease. And, you know, this cop ends up pulling me over in the parking lot of my job. This was not a very pretty arrest. It was in the parking lot of my job. He pulls up next to me, and he has me open my passenger door, and of course all this pot goes into his face, and he asks me if I had any drugs on me, and I told him, well, yeah, you know. I was told don't lie to them. Somebody gave me this information. Don't lie to police officers. They'll only get mad if you do. So, okay, I didn't lie. Bad move. Anyway, I end up going to jail, and I lost my job for that. I remember, you know, when I was in there, it didn't really dawn on me much that I wasn't very embarrassed. I wasn't very scared, but I can't say that it was really much of a sense of a relief either that I was getting arrested. But you know, I knew at that point, you know, that I was tired. You know, I was tired of doing something, but I wasn't willing to give up. You know, I wasn't willing to stop. So anyways, I go to jail. My mom picks me up. Actually, I get let out that night. I didn't know where I was. You know, I didn't know that Elmwood was in Milpitas. And so, you know, I thought I was going to walk home. You know, I live in, you know, at this time, what was it, South San Jose, wherever, like, you know, Kaiser is, and Blossom Hill, whatever. So anyways, I thought I was going to walk home, and I'm looking around, and nothing looked familiar, so I guess I have to call my mom. So, you know, she came and picked me up and took me to her house, and I stayed there for, I don't know, a day or something like that, just sleeping. And, you know, they told me, you know, that when I get back to my friend's house, when they drop me off, to take a shower, make an appointment, meet my boss, and see if I can't get my job back. Because it didn't make sense to me on how I lost my job for getting arrested on the premises, because, you see, I wasn't on the clock yet. So it really didn't make sense to me on why I lost my job. You know, what I do on my own time is my own business. So, you know, I called them and they said, no, you don't have a job. And, you know, I was not following directions. I just kind of called them. I was supposed to go in. Anyways, they said, no, you don't have a job. And I, you know, like I said, I didn't think this was right. So my friend says, well, why don't you call the union? Which I did. And I told him, look, this is what happened. And they said, well, do you want to do something about it? And I said, well, yeah. And so they ended up picking me up 3 hours later. They sent somebody from Santa Rosa to take me to a 30-day inpatient program. And what happened was, you know, like I said, I wasn't willing to stop. I didn't know I had a problem. I didn't know that there was anything wrong. All I knew is that everyone that I hung around with did this too, and that you know, I just happened to go to jail. Well, people around me went to jail, too. Just about everyone in my family went to jail. This is normal stuff. It just happened, you know, big deal. You know, do you like that? you know, these people are coming to pick me up, and my friend ended up, you know, calling everybody that she possibly could. Bring stuff over. Let's get her loaded as loaded as she can, you know, before she has to go away for 30 days. And I just thought that this was going to be something for me to take a rest, you know. I didn't know that when I got here that I was going to learn anything and that I was going to be willing or open enough to hear what they had to share with me. And I ended up going in there, not seeing how deteriorated I was becoming. When I was arrested, I was about 80 pounds. I had dark circle under my eyes. I could not complete a full sentence, and I thought I looked damn good, you know. And I was pathetically just sick. But like I said, I did not know that I had a problem. I did not see how physically sick I was, and I get into this program, and I started sharing with them from the get-go. I had shared with a lot of people during my years of life. You know, I was a whopping 20 years old. You know, things that had happened, but I never shared with one person everything. So I go into this place and I share with them stuff that's going on with me, my life, a little bit, not that open, but they did ask a lot of questions. They kind of opened me up. And I ended up sharing with them, you know, who I was, how weird I felt, how unnormal I felt, how alienated I felt, how much I just didn't feel like I fit in with anybody or anything around me. And they ended up, you know, sharing with me about the disease of alcoholism, and, you know, with that, other dependencies too. And, you know, I started listening. They said something. I don't know what it was, but they really caught my attention. You know, they shared with me that, you know, living the way that I'm living, you know, these are my options in life. You know, I'm going to die. You know, I mean, I'm either going to end up in jail, institutions, or death, is what they told me. And, you know, the way I was going, I'm already in an institution, been to jail, and I'm, you know, I'm pretty damn sick here. You know, if what happened, if I didn't go to jail, I couldn't say that I would still be here right now. You know, I did not see it. My eyes, I was totally closed to the whole how I was living. I did not see it at all. I was totally blinded. And, you know, for me, looking back now, I think that was God working in my life because, like I said, I didn't see it. I was not willing to stop. It was just how I was going. And for me to be open to hearing somebody and hearing the suggestions and hearing the way that, hearing the suggestions that they had for me, you know, and actually applying them into my life, that too for me was God working in my life, because that was not normal for me. You know, I was not supposed to go and do a lot of things when I was little. Wasn't supposed to steal, wasn't supposed to, you know, have premarital sex and stuff like that. Did it all. I ended up, when I was there, I ended up with a lot of hope. I remember they had me do this pie chart thing, and I remember one day that there was this big area of it that just said that I had hope. I had hope that, you know, that this could actually work for me, that my life could actually get better. I remember when I was in there, I started walking straight. I stood up straight. I had my head up high, and I felt good about who I was for probably the first time that I could ever remember. I liked who I was to some degree. I can't say, you know, after, you know, 20-something days that I felt, yeah. But I was beginning to feel stuff about myself and get some confidence, some self-esteem that was completely unnormal to me. You know, these people started giving me love and acceptance, which was not something that was normal to me either. I even questioned it at one time. I even got really mad at some counselors. I thought that they just, you know, were picking on me. You know, these are women. They're evil. You know, women are a very evil species. And, you know, they... you know, and it wasn't about that. It was that they truly wanted to give to me what they had learned, you know, and they didn't have any expectations in return. They didn't want anything in return. They just wanted, you know, to show me another way that there is possibilities. And you know what? I left there with all this knowledge. I left there with all this hope and this program that they had given me, this design for living. And, you know, they had me write down all these meetings that I was going to go to, and, you know, they told me to go to a woman's meeting, so therefore I'm not distracted by all you men. They told me to go to a step study meeting, therefore I can learn, you know, the steps of this program, a big book meeting, so I can learn about the alcoholism and you know, what's in that book. And they told me to go to a speaker meeting, so therefore I'm not sitting in the rooms in fear that, you know, I'm going to get called on. You know, that's one of the good things about going to a speaker meeting. But they told me not to only go to speaker meetings, you know, because I have to participate too. So they told me to go to a topic discussion meeting, and then I think there's one or two after that that, you know, that were for my choice, go to whatever it was I felt like going to. So you know, I had this whole diagram written out, and you know, when I got out of there, I was so jazzed. I was so excited. And I ended up, you know, going to a meeting that night. And the next day, you know, I kind of, you know, that alcoholism, that thinking starts, you know, that I don't need this. You know, I was just in treatment for 30 days. I don't need this, you know. And not that I didn't need it, but I thought I knew enough to keep me sober. And I just asked a lot of questions. They taught me a lot. I was open to hearing it all. I knew, and I was going to teach all of you, but tonight I'm going to take the night off. You know, I don't need to go to meeting tonight. So anyways, I did that, and I did that for a few days here, a few days there. Next thing you know, I'm going to one meeting a week. This guy's back in my life again, this guy that I was totally obsessed over, that I wanted to be with. And I'm hanging out at my friend's house still, living at her house for free. And you know, the night came where a party came up. You know, I had been going to maybe one meeting a week, went to a meeting that night, went to my aftercare group, actually, was what it was. And my friend, she was in Hawaii with her mom, and this guy that I had this major crush on, he asked if I was going to party with them. And I said, no, you know, this isn't for me. And him and his friend were kept asking me and kept, asking me. And I ended up starting to get that feeling of, I'm no fun sober. You know, they don't like me sober. I'm not a very fun person. And, you know, if I had been going to meetings, you know, and working this program, I can't say how it would have been, but I'm assuming that my foundation would have been a little bit stronger, that hopefully I would have done what in my conscience was telling me to do, and what I was being told to do was call your sponsor. You know, call your sponsor. And, you know, I didn't listen to that voice. And that night, I ended up drinking again. I had about 78 days sober, and I ended up taking that drink. And that drink ended up leading into another drink, ended up leading me into driving my car up to this mountain house and trying to find a bag. And when she didn't want to support my habit because she knew what I was trying to do, I ended up leaving there, and I was crying. I was crying so hard that I'd failed and that I had done something that I didn't want to do, and that I was a failure, and I felt the remorse, you know, and I was screaming out to God, just let me die, God. I just don't want to be here. Let me die. And I realized at that moment that the only way that I was going to die is if I drove my car right off the cliff. And I thought, nope, that's suicide. You know, if I do that, I'm going to hell, straight to hell. So I ended up, still screaming, and I mean, just, you know, tears and everything coming down my face. And what happened was I ended up crashing my car into the cliff instead. And I couldn't get it off. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. A car finally comes by, and, I flag him down, and he gets my car off the cliff for me, or the mountainside. And, you know, the funny thing is, I'm just here asking God for help. I realize that, you know, this is not what I want to do. You know, I wanted to change my life so bad, and here I am doing the same thing again, and now I crashed my car. I humiliated myself. I just fractured my wrist in this accident, and the first thing I do is I go to a drug dealer's house. You know, that's my thinking. Get me off here so I can go get loaded. It wasn't about, you know, what's best for me anymore. It was about being under the grips, you know, of the disease. And I ended up, the next day when I finally woke up, I realized, you know, that I was full of that remorse. I was full, just sick of what I had done and that I resorted to again. What happened was I ended up, crashing my car, fracturing my wrist, losing my job. I got back, getting kicked out of that house I was staying at in complete humiliation. And that was all in less than 24 hours that I had managed to do all of that. And that was what I did when I drank. So I remember I called my sponsor at the time, and she told me to go to a meeting. And that night I went, that afternoon I ended up meeting her at a meeting. She was chairing it. And I sat there in one of the chairs, and I was crying, and this guy tapped on this girl's shoulder and said, look at her. And she came and she gave me some love, and she just, you know, she asked if there's anything she can do for me. And, you know, I kind of told her that I went out, I got loaded, and my sponsor suggested to me that I do 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, it had been suggested to me before, but I realized that this is something that I really wanted. And, you know, like I said, with all the steps that I did in less than 24 hours, I can imagine what 48 hours would have been like. Or, you know, a few weeks, whatever. Anyways, I ended up doing exactly what she suggested. And I did 90 meetings in 90 days. Okay, actually, I did 88 meetings in 90 days. Actually, I did more than that, but I had to stop on day 88. I ended up going back to jail. But I did try. I asked them if they had meetings. I was going to more than one meeting a day. But anyways, I did what she suggested. I called her quite often. I shared with her what was going on with me on a daily basis. I was writing in a journal. I was reading the book, outlining it, going to meetings, hanging out with people that were clean and sober. I ended up, like I said, I got kicked out of this one home, so I ended up moving into this other house and renting a room. And, you know, they told me when I got here, you know, the only thing you have to change is everything. And, you know, it was kind of put in my life that I had to. I got kicked out of this house, and the only other place available to me was miles away, was in Los Gatos, and I was, you know, here off of whatever, you know, by Kaiser Hospital. So anyways, basically I changed my friends. I started going to meetings all the time, started meeting people, And slowly but surely, what I learned is that I started fitting in somewhere. You know, this is the one place that I felt that I had, that I was allowed to be myself, you know, and it's been proven to me over and over again that, you know, you guys have accepted me for who I am, and you guys have not tried to change me, you have not belittled me for who I am. And that to me is a beautiful thing, you know, the support that I've gotten here. I ended up, what happened for me is I ended up, my car stopped working. I blew the engine up. These things need oil every now and then, in case nobody knows that. Oil in the car, necessity. Anyway, blew my car up. And what I did is I didn't have a car for about a year. And what I was supposed to do, or, you know, I lived up in this little mountain house once again, or up this big long road. It was not walking distance. And what I had to do for me and for my sobriety is I had to get on that phone every day. And those phone numbers that I was told to get, I ended up using them. I ended up reaching out and asking for help on a daily basis because I did not miss going to a meeting. And sometimes I went to more. There was one occasion where, you know, I wanted to go to a meeting. It became accustomed to me to go to a meeting, and I couldn't find a ride, so I called a cab, you know. And I remember when I got to the meeting, I told somebody what I had done, and they said, you know what, that's willing. That's being willing to go to any length to stay sober. And I was proud of that. I was like, wow, that is, isn't it, you know. And I was very proud of that I was willing to do that. It was suggested to me to go to meetings, and so I did. You know, what I was told on being here is that, you know, I come up here and I announce myself as an alcoholic, then, you know, I was told that what I have is a built-in forgetter, and I don't come to these meetings, you know, I come to these meetings, you know, for me and to give the message out too. When I come to meetings and I announce myself as an alcoholic, I know at that moment I see, you know, it reminds me every day that I'm an alcoholic every time I do that. And that's what I was told, is that, you know, that we can forget those things. You know, we forget those times that we have. And I don't ever want to forget those. You know, when I come up here and I share my story on what it was like, you know, it reminds me of where I came from and where I was going and where I could be or maybe dead. And, you know, for that, that's what keeps me coming back, is I don't ever want to end up there again, you know. What I did is my sponsor suggested a lot of things to me. You know, she suggested that I start doing the steps, and I did do the steps. You know, she had me write out every single step, and I did them. You know, I was very willing when I got here because, like I said, I didn't want to end up back where I was. You know, I remember I shared in my story that I was very, very timid and very scared and very shy. I remember when I was in high school, this one girl, she moved her arm like this for some apparent reason. I ducked. I thought she was going to hit me. That was the behavior I got when I was at home. And you know what? She kind of laughed at me, like, what are you doing? You think I'm going to hit you? And I thought, natural reaction for me when someone moves their hands fast like that. I thought I was going to get hit. But that wasn't the case. You know, I've grown up here in a way where people don't see me as being that timid, scared person anymore. I'm a pretty outgoing person, and like I said, I absolutely insist on having fun. You know, I go places and I do things, and I do things with people that support me and that love me. You know, there was a period of time that I was hanging out with this one guy, and you know, we just had a ball. We went out and we did stuff, and we were just obnoxious together. And you know, it was probably one of the most supporting things that I could have gone through. This is about a year ago. One of the most supporting things I could have gone through, because he allowed me to be me. And on top of that, I ended up getting a roommate that was exactly the same way, you know, that laughs at me and laughs with me about who I am and doesn't belittle me and does not try to change me, but enjoys me just for who I am. And you know what? I love that. You know, when I was younger, it was always be this way, be that way, don't do this, don't do that. You know, that's embarrassing. You're this, you're that. And you know, I don't get that. You know, and I've gotten that kind of support where I'm okay more today with myself than I ever have been before. I don't know don't know. I've gotten so much out of this program. You know, if it's a sense of belonging, a sense of who I am, the fact that, you know, I've worked all these steps more than once. I've had different sponsors. And, you know, I've grown from them. I've changed who I am. And, you know, like I said, I've enjoyed watching myself, seeing who I am today. You know, it says in the spiritual experience, I believe is what it's called in the back of the book, that, you know, a lot of people will see things in me that I won't see. They'll see them long before I will. And, you know, that's true for me today. I don't see half of the stuff that's going on with me, the changes in me, until somebody else points it out. I've had people tell me, you know, what they think about or the person they see before them, meaning me, and it's nothing compared to what I think of me. You know, I was called a thief, I was called a liar, I was called, you know, nasty little names all the time, and now I'm told that I'm a kind person. You know, that I'm fun, I'm smart, you know, I'm a good-hearted person, that I'm a free spirit. I get told things like that, and you know what, I love that. You know, where else am I going to get something like that? I didn't get it at home. You know, that's the place that I was supposed to get all the love and nurturing. I didn't get it there, and I'm getting it here, which is just absolutely beautiful to me. I have friends here that I've had for the amount of time I've been here. I've been sober 7 years now, and I know the same people for 7 years, and not once have they ever told me, you know what, Kamala, stop following me around like a fucking puppy dog. You know, never have they told me to do that. And you know what, I like that. I like the people who are in my life today. You know, I know there's people that are here tonight, and that they're here to support me. You know, there's a few, and I appreciate that. You know, wonderful things have happened to me in my sobriety, you know, and it's not to say, you know, I've had my hard times too. I've been through a period of time where I've had to make some of the hardest, devastating decisions in my life, you know, and, but you know what, I got through them, and I didn't have to take anything, you know, but from the person that was told that they were stupid, that they weren't going to amount to anything, you know, you know, right now I've been working at the same job now for 7 years now. I've gotten promoted, you know, up to the manager of the department. And, you know, I'm in a position where, you know, they took me to Seattle on a business trip. You know, me? I work for a natural food store, and they're taking me out to Seattle. They're going to be taking me possibly to New York or Oregon again. These are the things that they're doing for me. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I still got that thinking of I'm not quite good enough, you know, that I've got all these people fooled, you know, I'm really not this good, you know, and I'm that smart to fool all of you, and pretty soon you guys are going to see what a failure I really am. But you know what, if that's the case, then I've been fooling them for 7 years now, and you know, they promoted me over, and I'm the type of person where I go in, and when I'm on the schedule, they can count on me to be there. When they ask me to do something, they can count on it, that I'm going to get it done, and they, you know, they have acknowledged that to me, too. You know, they said, Kamala, you know what? I really appreciate the fact that when I ask you to do something, you know, that you do it, you know. And, you know, I've learned how to be responsible here. You know, it says up here on this board up here, it says, I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And, you know, like I said, my time is up. You know, I was asked to do a speaker meeting, and so I said yes. I've been doing the same Friday night 6 o'clock step steady meeting for over a year now, and you know, you're not going to hear me bitch and complain about it. You know what, I like doing it. It keeps me sober, it keeps me in the book, and it keeps me here. This is my home group. Saturday Night Live has been my home group for 7 years now, and I absolutely love it. I love the people that are here. My name is up on the board again. I'm on the service board in more than one position right now. I love being in service. When people ask me to do something, I try to be there, because you know what, if you guys weren't here for me, you know, I can't say that my life would be where it is right now. You guys giving me your time and your love to me, you know, helping me grow up. I got here when I was 21 years old. You know, I was scared, and I'm not to say that that's any different than, you know, whatever you know, however old you all are. But you know what? I was very, you know, very young, very new to the, you know, whole life thing, you know, still learning. And, you know, you all taught me how to grow up here. You guys have watched me, and you guys taught me, you know, and I've been very open to asking for help, which is, you know, very difficult for an alcoholic or for just about anybody to do, you know, to ask for help. And I don't know why. I can be very open to asking for help. I want help, you know. I don't know how to do a lot of things, you know, and I ask for it, and I admit when I don't know how to do it. Where that comes from, I don't know. But anyways, you know, I've reaped a lot of benefits from being here. You know, I've got a God in my life today that is definitely, you know, that holds my hand through each of my days. And, you know, through those tough times, you know, I definitely believe that He carries me through. You know, I don't do anything by myself today. You know, before I got up here, I prayed to God that, you know, I could be a channel in which His message can flow through me. And, you know, and I hope that I've been able to do that, you know, to share with some of you, you know, what it was like for me, and that hopefully somebody got something out of it. If not, you know, I know where I came from, and I remember, and hopefully it'll keep me sober one more night, because I don't want to go back to where it was that I was, or to live that life again, not tonight anyways. You know, I'm just very happy. I have a relationship, you know, not to to clear this up real fast, I have a relationship with my mom right now that is absolutely priceless. You know, they tell me in the promises that we will have relationships that are priceless, and you know, I do today. I have a sense of forgiveness, and through doing the steps and getting to step 8 and 9, you know, that I learned forgiveness. And the reason why I share this about my mom is because, you know, I realized at one period in my life when I first got sober is that, you know, my mom did the best she could with the tools that she was given, you know, and that she was not the type of person that she was towards me, because she just woke up and decided that this is how she wanted to treat her daughter one day. This is the same behavior that she got when she was younger. It was taught into her, but you know, it's my choice now, and I get to stop that pattern right now in my life, and it doesn't have to go any further than where it was. And you know what? I like that. I like to know that I don't have to do some of the behavior that was taught to me, you know, that it's my choice now. And like I said, I have a relationship with my mom today that is absolutely beautiful. You know, we call each other up, and she's a friend to me today. You know, she is someone that I absolutely love talking to, that we get together, and we just have a blast. And, you know, from somebody who didn't seem like they liked me very much, to somebody who loves hanging out with her daughter. And, you know, she came up to me one day, and she gave me a hug, and she told me she loved me, and, you know, that just about made me cry. It got me right in my stomach, you know, this, my mother loves me, you know, which was not a feeling that I had when I was younger. I kind of felt outcasted, and, you know, she does. And for me, it was a process of working these steps and showing that my mother, no matter what, that I forgive her, and showing her the love also in return, you know, that I got that with her. And, anyways, my hour's up. Thanks.